You are listening to the Fusion Patrol Podcast.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Fusion Patrol Podcast. I'm Eugene.
And I'm Ben.
And we're here tonight on opposite sides of the planet so that we can bring you all our latest insights on the latest Doctor Who episode, Vincent and the Doctor.
And that is how dedicated we are, by virtue of me being still here in Phoenix and you being in Taiwan.
Yes, that is pure dedication. The time zones are working against us. The internet is working against us. The stars aren't even aligned right. But we are here because we are committed. Should be committed, however that works out.
Well, I don't know. I almost bought it.
Do you know the funny thing about the time zone thing? Is that I completely botched up when the episode of Doctor Who was airing.
Whoops.
And I didn't realize that whereas it would be Saturday afternoon in England, it's like in the middle of the night on Sunday here. Ah. So I missed it. I was like, you know, I better check on that pretty soon. It's like, oh my gosh, I missed it.
Oh dear.
Yeah. Anyhow, but I did watch it, so subsequently since then, but not in my usual timely fashion. So,
I think you can be forgiven this one time.
I suppose. Next week we'll see. Anyway, so let's just plop right into it. What's your reaction?
Wow. Let me just start it off by saying it was nothing what I had expected it to be. I don't remember if we discussed this on the air last week.
I think we did, but I cut it out.
Oh, fuck, right.
By the way, if anybody listening, I cut out all of Ben's and David's lines last week. It was just, it was an editing thing, and it was, no.
Okay. Yeah, sure. All right. But we had discussed what our initial thoughts were going to be of this episode. And we were all kind of the thought that this one was going to really tank. And yeah. It was not at all what I had expected it to be. I will start it off with that. I don't know if you want me to go point by point.
Well, I'll agree with you completely on that one. It was not what I expected it would be, and I was pleasantly surprised. I'll go so far as to say.
I was too.
But I'll tell you, my kids were bored senseless.
Well, it's not your typical Monster of the Week episode, and that starts me on point one. What I really couldn't stand was the Grafeus and the use of this creature. It served merely as a very weak plot device to get the Doctor and Amy to travel back in time and spend time with Vincent van Gogh. The real thrust of the story is about the three of them together, not about them trying to overcome this thing that is tormenting van Gogh. And not to mention the fact they never even really discuss how is it that he was able to see this invisible creature. Yeah. I found that a little peculiar, but then maybe no more peculiar than the Doctor being able to see it in his mirror.
So let me ask you this question. Would the story have worked if the creature had been nothing more than the product of a madman's mind?
It might have actually been better. I think I would have accepted that a little bit better because then it's directly tied to Vincent himself as opposed to being just this separate thing, which it ended up becoming. So I didn't care for the creature. Again, I thought it was a very weak plot point. I didn't care for the way they killed it, essentially, how it met its demise. I found that just added insult to injury on the weak use of a creature that didn't even qualify as your monster of the week. It didn't even qualify that much. It was so transparent. Pardon the pun, but it really served no viable story purpose for this entire episode. The only thing about it that I did like regarding the Grafeus is that we were kept in the dark just as much as the Doctor and Amy were regarding the nature of the Grafeus. that being it's blind. It can only move around by sound. It was scared.
How did it get
felt out of place.
Sorry. How did it get inside the church if it was blind?
Who knows?
Just found a door, opened it up.
It just made its way in.
Came in and with again, the parishioners and killed them all. Wait, nobody. It's just kind of odd.
Yeah, and that added to its two-dimensionalness. That's why I thought it really failed as a story element. So on that aspect, I really didn't care for the creature at all. And again, point two, I didn't like how they got rid of it. It just seemed really weak, almost a bit anticlimactic. So it ended up being an extremely disappointing story element for me.
I appreciate the fact that they killed it with a stick, and I'll tell you why. Because far too often in Doctor Who stories or any story, we have a creature which is obviously just flesh and blood and fairly ordinary. And, you know, the Brigadier tries to shoot it. Oh, no, of course, it's completely bulletproof, blah, blah, blah. This creature strikes me as one that you could poke a stick at and kill. I mean, it's a big stick, obviously, and you'd need to get it in the right spot. But at least it wasn't, you know, invulnerable.
It wasn't invulnerable. Yeah.
What seemed kind of obvious.
That didn't bother me. That the fact that they killed it is what bothered me, not the fact that it was vulnerable to a very, very pointy stick. That didn't bother me so much. It's the fact that they spend so little time on this creature, we find out very little about it, and now we've killed it.
Dare we say,
or
at least
the doctor's killed it. It was very unsatisfying. I felt it was unnecessary. So all of that, I really did not care for. Now, let me jump to point number
three.
Well, two, sir, three, sir. Something that I did like. Now, just as we had commented on the previous two-parter that Doctor Who episode sort of felt like a return to the Jon Pertwee, this one felt like a really strong return to the Patrick Troughton era for me. You see the Doctor being a bit of a real bumbling idiot, but not to the point where it took anything away from his brilliance. He just was very, very goofy, and it reminded me of the old Troughton episodes. And what I loved was the tech that he had to use in the more recent episodes, especially when you're talking about the Eccleston and especially the David Tennant episodes. The Doctor would come up with unbelievable, brilliant, unbelievably just genius methods of detecting the creature, and what does the Doctor do in this one? He pulls out this incredible piece of technology that he has to wear around his entire torso with a rear view mirror and a dial on it. And I thought, you know, this kind of takes me back to the craziness of the Patrick Troughton episodes, and that I really did enjoy. So I found the portrayal of the Doctor in this particular episode a lot of fun. A little bit inconsistent, perhaps, if you want to look at the overall storytelling of the character thus far. But still, it was a nice, refreshing change to see him in this kind of light. Yeah. To see him acting as a bit of a slightly bumbling, eccentric Doctor.
Well, fair enough. Fair enough. I found his portrayal fairly consistent. There were a couple points where I was thinking about how he is doing that odd moving kind of, it's like his timing is off, where he doesn't know when to walk out of a room. It's an awkward pause that this Doctor has, and I noticed it a couple times in this episode, more so than usual. But it doesn't bother me. It just gives it a sort of almost inhuman. He isn't acting the way a human would act in a room. Either that, or he's just uber geek nerd.
Well, that kind of brings the question: is this something that Matt Smith is doing, or is this something that he's been more or less directed to do? If this is something that he's introducing himself, I would think that it might be a good idea for the writers and the directors in the future to maybe capitalize on it. Don't overly exploit it, but keep that little characteristic in them. Each doctor is supposed to have a little quirk to them in some fashion or another. I like the idea of him being a little out of sync, which for a Time Lord is truly funny if you think about it. For him to be just a little bit of out of sync with his own surroundings, to behave in that particular manner. So I would hope that they might keep that quality in him. It gives him just enough whimsy to make him a lot of fun to watch, as opposed to brooding doctors such as Chris Eccleston.
Mm. Well, I'll tell you,
I'm biased. What can I say?
One thing I loved was the line. So is this how time goes for everyone else? Something like slowly and
yes.
In order.
And I found that too. The doctor clearly has no sense of patience whatsoever. I mean, I suppose why would a Time Lord need any?
Well,
but here he's in a situation where he has to. Yeah, but here he's in a situation now where he just can't. He has to wait for the outcome to occur. He just can't jump to it or cause it to happen. I think that's something that the doctor has done historically, is to engineer the situation so that he gets his results immediately. So that, you know, he's caught up in today's generation of instant gratification, and now he's got to think back. Oh, Jesus! Is this what you puny humans are all about? Having to wait for things to happen. I had to laugh at that. I thought that was a great touch.
It might be insightful. It might be an insightful commentary on the audience that's watching the program. For all we know, it's the writer taking a stick at the rest of us. But that could be wishful thinking on my part.
Yeah.
So, what do you think of Vincent van Gogh himself in this story, the portrayal?
I liked it. I liked it a lot. I like how they addressed his mental issues. That he was clearly a nut. He was a nutcase.
I kind of wondered if they did a job on that. In other words, at the end of as it was aired in Britain anyway, they had a thing about, you know, do any of these issues touch you? Call us up.
Right.
Whatnot.
Yeah, they had a PSA.
And it wasn't even clear that was about mental issues. It could have been about blindness, for all I know, because it could have been, you know, the whole Grafaeus and the blindness. Maybe it was, you know, call us about the blindness. They never once called him for what he was, I mean, apart from nuts.
Well,
but
well, there was one brief moment, and they just glossed over it really, really, really quickly. And that is right as Vincent was about to start painting, I believe, the church. Mm-hmm. The doctor starts talking to him and says, you know, you may not be mad.
Right.
This may be depression. And he just talks on it really, really briefly. I think it was more implied in terms of how Vincent was portrayed, that he had this issue. I certainly recognized it. I saw it immediately for what it was, and I was very grateful for it, that it didn't get too necessarily preachy. I do have a friend who works for the BBC in Britain, and he was, while he didn't mind the episode too much, he found the PSA highly offensive because he battled depression himself. But it, he thought they got a little heavy-handed. I never got that sense.
I thought it was glossed over, but I guess
yeah. If anything, they handle it maybe a little bit too delicately. So that was my only issue.
I mean,
that maybe it wasn't touched on enough. But I think it was more portrayed in just the actor's performance, which I thought was pretty darn solid in terms of watching him flip back and forth from a depressive state to an almost manic one. I mean, this was he was bipolar to an extreme like I'd never seen before. But he performed it, he acted it in a very convincing manner. I think the director and maybe even the Grand Moff decided to leave it at that.
Well, it was an interesting. I enjoyed the performance. I don't know how it. That I must admit, I kept thinking of Billy Connolly. He's a Scottish comedian. That there was,
I know him, yeah.
A lot of that kept, and that may be a horrible stereotype, but I don't get that from Amy when she's talking in a Scottish accent. There was just something about this guy's delivery that I just kept thinking, that could be Billy Connolly. And if I'm not mistaken, I think Billy Connolly might be a manic depressive as well. I think I read something about that somewhere, but if not, sorry, Billy, but something about that with regards to him. So maybe that was, he based his performance on him. I don't know.
Yeah. One thing that I really had issues with, I was excited to know that this was going to be in the episode or that this person was going to be in the episode, but was a little dismayed by how he was used, and that's Bill Nighy. I really like him a lot. He's capable of such really interesting portrayals in different shows, and I thought I thought he was kind of a waste as an actor.
I'm not familiar with him. I know who he is in this episode, and I know that he was one of the potential choices as a doctor. For during the Russell T. Davies era. I don't know whether that was at Eccleston's time or when they bring in Tennant. And so I don't know if they dressed him up like a doctor, you know, our doctor, to convey that or just happen to be that part. He gave a great performance at it. It was certainly very well. It came across very well. I don't know how he acts in other programs, but he came off as a sort of overly knowledgeable tour guide, professor kind of thing. He turned in a very credible performance for what he was doing there.
True, but knowing what he is capable of doing, how he's capable of acting, I've seen him in just a few things. I mean, I've seen him in the last two of the Pirates of the Caribbean films. And then I know him best as Slarty Bartfast in the last... Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy movie that came out a few years ago.
Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy movie, but I remember him from that now. Yes, that is where I've seen the guy before.
And I thought, and in fact, oddly enough, he was the only thing about that film that I really liked. I thought everything else about that movie was just dreadful, but I liked him. And I saw him again in, I think it was Superfuzz that came out in England some years back. Cute, fun police film, comedy. So I was kind of looking forward to seeing what they were going to do with him in this episode. It was a good acting performance, but I come back to anybody could have done that. There was nothing really spectacular that really said Bill Nighy. Anybody could have done that part the way it was written. So while he did a very capable and very competent job in the part, I felt that it was a waste of his talent.
Well, isn't that true of a lot of the guest star appearances that they put in the shows, though? I mean, they're all a waste. They're there to get the guy's name, and so their grandkids can say, "Ooh, Grandpa was on Doctor Who," kind of thing, for the most part.
Yeah, I suppose so. I mean, I'm reminded immediately of Invasion of the Dinosaurs with Terry Jones, and I thought, what a waste. What a complete waste. So, yeah, that's very true. Now, let me get on the one thing that I really, really loved and I think set the entire tone for this episode. And that was Vincent himself. I liked the actor. I liked him a great deal. I liked how he played the part. I know very little of Vincent Van Gogh. I will admit I'm not one of his fans. I'll just put that right out there right now. I've never been a big fan of his work. He's not quite my style. I'm not saying that his work is trash. Obviously, there's a lot of people that love his work, and if they do, then great. They're seeing something that I'm not, and that's fine. So I know very, very little of Vincent Van Gogh as an artist. I will say, with the limited knowledge that I have, I thought our actor did a brilliant job playing the part. I mean, it's very demanding to jump back and forth playing that kind of a bipolar person, to be able to be very excited and see the mysteries of life and everything around you and for it to excite you, and then to become this very sad, almost self-loathing person the next. Not an easy thing to do. Very difficult acting. And I thought he did a brilliant job with that. And the way the doctor and Amy related to him, I thought was very sympathetic, very touching. And I know that some people are going to really rap me for this one, but I loved purely from an emotional standpoint, I loved it when they took him to modern day to the Louvre, so that his work could be seen.
Well, I don't disagree. His performance was great. I thought, and I will go on here a little bit about Van Gogh. I'm not sure which it is, but I'll go
Gogh.
He's
a serpent worm.
Yes. I'm kind of with you. I'm not a huge fan of his work. We used to have this, we had Starry Night was on the wall in my elementary school from first to fifth grade, just outside the boys' room, which coincidentally is where they lined us up to go to the boys' room where we took turns. So I actually spent a lot of time studying that picture as a young child. I don't know what it is, but the picture was fascinating to me. I didn't like it, but it was fascinating to me. I spent an inordinate amount of time looking at that painting going, how could he get it so wrong? Quite literally, what was in my mind is like, that's, no one could be fooled by that picture.
That's not what the stars look like up in the sky.
That's exactly right. Now, that's an interesting point, because if we leap that forward, is that what they're telling us why Van Gogh can see the Griffes? Because what he sees is not what we see.
I think that was the implication.
And
that he was able to see things through whatever madness he may have had. And
was it the madness that allowed him to see it, or was it his ability to see things that no one else could, what drove him to madness?
The answer to that would be yes.
Yes, thank you.
Both. I mean, I think one feeds the other.
I don't want to say it blew my mind, but I was really shocked when they pulled that piece out, and I said, wow, the fact that he paints stuff that isn't what it looks like is exactly what I've always thought he was. I mean, nowhere near as bad as Picasso, who is crap painting, but you know, the impressionist movement, and it's like, yeah, it doesn't look like that, but what the heck, we'll just slap some stuff. I'm convinced it's a product of the art world more than it is a product of the reality of the art. I mean, I think the fact that the peasants don't like his work does not reflect on the peasants. It reflects upon his work. But, you know, take that as may, time is what time is, and we, on this podcast, can't unwrite it, and he is famous, and some of his work is... It's got a lovely use of colors. I'm going to go that far and say that it is very... It's very colorful and interesting, and you certainly can tell what he's painting, and that's far better than some painters.
I would definitely agree with that. His use of colors is particularly unique. Artistic style notwithstanding, I mean, you could look at any of his works and simply say, oh, well, I know that's a Vincent van Gogh.
Yes.
But yeah, I do like the use of colors. I'm with you. His work does not inspire me. I've seen other painters. I'm not a big fan of Impressionism, to be honest. That's not to invalidate it as an art form. It just means that it does nothing for me. So I think we're in agreement on that one.
You know,
we're not moved by his work.
It's funny though. I mean, I would tell you that completely, just what I just did. But thinking about it here in having spoken it out probably for the first time in my life, the amount of time I spent staring at that painting and not particularly appreciating it, but having an emotional reaction that perhaps in some way that painting did inspire me in a weird sort of way, and I just never realized it till this very moment.
Yeah, it's very possible. I mean, the whole idea of art is to, you know, we don't want to turn this into the artist's podcast, but to briefly digress, yeah, it is supposed to stimulate thought and feeling, and whether it be for good or bad, I mean, who's to say? So if it did stimulate you in that fashion, then perhaps it did serve its purpose.
Speaking of his ability to see things that weren't there, or at least weren't there for us, but they were there, what about Amy's loss, that he saw that? That was an interesting little piece.
Now that I think was very interesting. This is going to be the other thing that I was going to bring up in a moment. One thing that I really liked about this episode is that we really took a serious break from this entire story arc that had been woven since the very beginning of this year. And I really like that. The fact that they just tied it into the series by simply saying, you know, that Vincent recognized Amy's loss. So I thought that was an interesting little touch. I'm glad we didn't have to have any references to Amy's crack. Anything like that. I mean, it's a good thing we didn't have to go down that road again.
We didn't have to go down Amy's crack again, doggone it.
Yeah, didn't have to go down Amy's crack. But it was interesting that Vincent did see it. And I think that's to serve as a reminder, merely just the tiniest reminder, that that particular storyline is not over. There's more to come. I mean, well, you know there's more to come. I mean, you saw you're aware of a spoiler on that, which we won't discuss.
We won't discuss, but...
No, we will not discuss. But still, that is to serve the viewer, that there clearly is more to that. So I thought that was kind of a neat little touch. And again, to have an episode that didn't dwell at any length on Amy's story, I actually thought was terribly refreshing. It was nice to see basically a standalone episode. And for that, I really liked it.
We had Ben Goff seeing Amy's pain that even Amy couldn't see. I mean, this is interesting in that, because we talked a little bit last week about the timey-wimey nature of how it doesn't make any sense. I mean, erasing someone from their memory doesn't make any sense. You have to have erased their actions. And how can we assume that Amy would be with the doctor or this, that? And we got a little... I'm going to go completely out of order here, and we got a little bit of feedback from our friend 110 over at the Little Storping in the Swuff blog. He was listening to the podcast and about our talk about the timey-wimey, and he sent a tweet over pointing this out brilliantly. He said, if Rory has just been erased from history, it's a tweet, so I'm paraphrasing it because it was much shorter than this. What was the last thing Rory did before he was erased?
He pushed the doctor out of the way.
He saved the doctor's life. So if he didn't exist...
then the doctor would be dead.
Yes. So obviously history itself is not being unwritten.
Just memories.
Just memories. In some sort of bizarre timey-wimey fashion. Anyway...
which, that would make sense. If you go back to the Weeping Angels two-parter that we had... By virtue, and here's an interesting little bit. Remember that Amy was able to remember all these people. She could remember all these soldiers that were being written out of history. And now, and again, they got to that, whatever point they were during that story, they got there
with the aid of
through the
soldiers.
Collective, through the aid of the soldiers. It was the collective group that got them there. So to start taking them out one by one, I mean literally rewriting history as if they never existed, would have diminished their results and they would not have ended up where they were. So that makes perfect sense to me, and it maybe perhaps reinforces, or at least it does sort of raise a question, you know, and we don't want to dwell too much on this story point, but why is it that in that story, Amy was able to remember the soldiers when no one else could?
Well, you know, the doctor did say that it had to do with being a time traveler, and then when Rory was being erased, Amy...
she couldn't remember.
She said to him, but didn't you say I'm a time traveler? I can never forget these things. Some words to that effect, and the doctor says, this is different. This is your past being erased. So, although that doesn't make any sense, because obviously the clerics were part of her past.
They're part of her more immediate past, but still her past.
So
that's a bad story bit.
It's timey-wimey. It's bad.
Yeah, but I do like the idea of at least it's not the actions that are being undone. It's simply the memory. Although that does raise a lot of, if you want to get into quantum mechanics, and the whole basis of how time works. I mean, if you want to go very, very sci-fi geeky, you know, that raises a lot of issues. How does something happen when the person wasn't there? That, those kinds of things. So it's great for Doctor Who, I suppose, because it's more of a, as Tom Baker once said, it's not science fiction. It's more like science fantasy. So I suppose with that kind of thing, you can get away with it because it's not really rooted in hard science.
Yeah.
Not like other television shows might have portrayed it. Well, so
I've got one more thing to point out. In case it wasn't clear, I actually enjoyed the episode. I didn't quite bring a tear to my eye. That was a little bit of a forced tear jerker at the end, but I felt that little tug, just a little tug there, the emotional thing towards the end of the story. But like I said, the kids were up going to the bathroom, and they didn't, you know, usually if that happens, they're like, pause it. And this time they were like, yeah, you can keep it running. So they weren't enthralled with the episode. But there was one thing of the whole episode that I detested. And that was, it wasn't the fact that they took him to Paris to see his works in the museum. It was the music interlude that they played at the end while he was doing that. I don't know who the band was. I don't care who the band was. It reminded me of the end of every stinking episode of House. I hate that music bit at the end where they just start playing music to try to, I don't know, because the story wasn't good enough to get the emotional response or the feel or the tone. And so they have to rely on they're trying to sell music for their label because people don't listen to radio anymore. But I just, you know, do you... I watched it twice. I still haven't got a clue what the lyrics were to the song because
I have no idea. And I heard it too. I didn't like it because to me it was very jarring. That's the first time we had anything that I can immediately recall of that nature. And to me, it's almost like, what is this, Doctor Who, or is this Dawson's Creek?
The iPod thing in the end of the world was pretty bad, but it was at least music that was in the room, not just
right.
You know, a musical interlude at the end.
In End of the World, it could be thought of as some sort of source music. So you can get away with that. You can forgive it. I could not forgive that. It was very much out of place. It really bothered me. Luckily, it did not last too long, and I chose to ignore it and more focus on what our actors were doing. And that brings me to what I most loved about this episode, and that was bringing Vincent van Gogh to see his work in modern day. I was going to say that what I loved about it is that here the Doctor, through an incredible act of charity and possibly even a sense of love that he has for the artwork and legacy that Vincent had left, takes him to the future, because all Vincent has ever done when they've met him is he's completely been self-critical to a very, very unhealthy extreme about his own work, what he's capable of doing. And it's all crap. He's no good. I mean, I think any artist could, any struggling artist could conjure up those old tapes in their head. And clearly Van Gogh was very much immersed in that sort of negativity, and for the Doctor to take him to the future so that he could see his work really did mean something, that there were people who were very much moved by it. And I thought it was a very beautiful scene the way it was presented. I mean, to actually have students, or what appeared to be art students, sitting on the floor.
School kids, yeah.
School kids, and they were contemplating. Deeply contemplating his work, and then come back to Bill Nighy.
And they weren't standing in line to go to the bathroom.
Yeah, but they weren't standing in line to go to the loo. You know, they're contemplating his work like you were.
Yeah.
So maybe there's really something to it. But here they were totally just immersed in what he had done. And then to hear the lecturer just wax beautifully about how for him he thinks, you know, that Van Gogh was probably one of the greatest treasures to ever come out of the art world.
I do appreciate that he said, for me, he is. That,
he made it very subjective.
Very, very personal, and that's far more important when discussing art.
Right, because art, and you're right, you're absolutely right. Art is a very, very subjective thing. You just don't pare it down to A and B, 1 and 2, black and white. It's more than that. There's a lot of human element to it. And to hear the lecturer say that, or the tour guide say, for me, there's nothing more powerful than you can tell an artist when you know that on some personal level you have affected a person or a group of people. And for Van Gogh to be able to be in that room and to realize that that what he was leaving was a legacy to be loved and enjoyed, cherished for however many years, possibly even into the far, 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 far future, that his work will endure, that he will be loved for all that. I mean, I think all of us at some point like to have that sort of Frank Capra kind of "It's a Wonderful Life" moment. At one point or another, to say, did my life make a difference? And here Van Gogh was able to finally realize, wow, my life did make a difference. And for someone who was battling mental illness like that, there's no greater greater treasure than hearing that.
All right. Well, it's just about the end of the line, but I've got one last question or one last thought just to put out there. Not going to answer that question tonight. But since the paintings were there, since that was the period of Van Gogh's most prolific, just prior to his demise, and since the doctor did take him to the future to see it, and it did not alter time, can we assume that the doctor was mostly always there, and that the doctor taking him to the future may have been what ultimately led him to commit his own suicide?
Boy. Well, you might want to leave that one for your listeners and have them all write in.
I don't know if this was intentional or whether it was just my thought or I'm just particularly dense and I'm thinking I'm being clever. But when the doctor said, get your stuff in your own time, we're going to go paint the church, and then we'll be out of your hair by tomorrow. Was I just imagining it, or was that the trigger? In other words, that's why he sunk into his black depression, right? He was in the room, and then he was like, "Oh, you guys are going to leave, and then I'll be back in my pit of despair," and all that kind of thing. And so,
it's very possible.
So the doctor and Amy leaving him, even though they did him a world of good, may have further contributed.
I got that thought because when he heard the TARDIS vanish and he looked back, you got a sense that two people that had come to mean a great deal to him. On so many different levels, are now gone. Even though he knew he had this wonderful, rich history that he was about to leave, I think their absence might have been. So maybe this was a classic historical case of the doctor was always meant to be there.
Yeah. So, alas, we had to have a monster in a historical, but such as it
was. And a cheaply done one at that.
But at least I would almost say they had an only judicious use of it, but they did use it a little too much, even for that. Once or twice in the mirror, and only then would have been good. Well, next week we're in a similar situation. I am overseas for another two more weeks here, so we don't know exactly when we will be able to schedule our time like we did today, which was done a little bit impromptu. So if we sounded a little unprepared, it's because we were. And we will see you next time. I'm Eugene.
And I'm Ben.
And see you next time, which I just said. So see you next time.
Fusion Patrol is produced by Lone Locust Productions. You can contact us at feedback@fusionpatrol.com. Our theme music is Fight the Future by Amber Wolf.